Hey, welcome back to Invisible Machines. I'm Josh Tyson, a contributing editor here at UX Magazine, and I'm joined again by resident visionary Rob Wilson, CEO and co-founder of OneReach.ai. Rob and I are co-authors of the best-selling book Age of Invisible Machines, and this podcast is where we continue our explorations of agentic AI. Today, we're excited to share a conversation with Mark Hijink, author of Focus the ASML Way. Mark is a financial reporter and technology columnist for the Dutch daily newspaper NRC, and his new book is the result of decades of embedded reporting on ASML, one of the most valuable technology companies in the world that most people have never even heard of. Using an incredibly complex and resource-intensive process called extreme ultraviolet lithography, ASML produces a staggering 90% of all chips worldwide, powering our smartphones, washing machines, traffic lights, and everything in between. Mark explains how it all came to be and provides insight into the ways that different cultures and global politics all affect the EUV process and pipeline, with China now making inroads into this critical foundational technology, which has historically been controlled by Western interests. This conversation is as timely as it is fascinating. Let's get into it with Mark Hijink.
So, we were just discussing this company. Can you see what I'm showing? These are like the next period chips that are being the center of the world's concern when it comes to the automotive sector, because everybody's screaming for these little parts. So actually, this might be pretty valuable because normally they cost like 4 cents. And now they go up to a dollar each because everybody's craving for these chips. Also, Dutch company. They're just basic switches. So they kind of guide electricity or send a current from left to right. So it's basically the nuts and bolts of any electronic device. These are really cheap chips. But if you don't have them, you can't build a
Build a car. And you can't just... You can't just make one yourself.
Definitely. And it's also very hard to replace them because the automotive industry is really strict when it comes to, certifying. Is that the right phrasing? So it usually takes 2 to 3 years to change any kind of any part of an EV because they don't want any callbacks or recalls because it's even more expensive.
Right. Yep. Yeah, for a, 4 cent chip, now $1.
It's crazy. And even Trump and Xi were talking about this company. And I'm right in the middle of it. So I've been following that company as well on background, just like I did with ASML. But I never expected this to happen. A lot of reporters are focused on having a scoop or the story out first. And to me, I think the value is usually in this long-term relationship where you tend to hear more and build out your network. And that creates a story that kind of has more of a holistic approach. I always emphasize that I don't own any shares in ASML. I didn't write about the company because the company wanted me to do it. It really was my own venture. And the company was crazy enough to let me inside their buildings and all of their suppliers and customers, but they also gave me the opportunity to do my own research external, so I could find alternative sources and do my basic reporting duty. And for me, that really was the extra value. And I think that was also part of ASML's expectation that they wanted an objective view, because to them it was more valuable to be transparent to the outside world, written by an outsider, because otherwise there's always this assumption, they're just being too positive about themselves. Or there's stuff in the book they really didn't like, but they're honest about it, and I really appreciate that urge for transparency. But now I have to do the news stories as well, so it's like a combo.
Yeah. This episode is brought to you by OneReach.ai, the runtime for AI agents. Their GSX platform provides turnkey private architecture and tools for building enterprise-grade agentic solutions. Recently, I worked with the team at OneReach to create an agentic companion for the second edition of Age of Invisible Machines. So now when you scan any of the QR codes found in either edition of the book, an agent is there to provide additional insight using a custom knowledge base. There's also a newsfeed feature with updates on agentic AI, as well as this podcast, and a book resources skill that provides clickable galleries of footnotes from each chapter. All of it built using the revolutionary Generative Studio X platform. Learn more at onereach.ai. If you're enjoying this conversation with Mark Hijink, I encourage you to check out a couple of other recent episodes. We have a great conversation with Karen Howe, author of Empire of AI. Karen was embedded at OpenAI for years, and her book is an unflinching look at the company. We also have a great episode with Stephen Witt, author of The Thinking Machine, which is a biography of Jensen Huang, and by extension, NVIDIA, his company that makes the GPU chips that power everything OpenAI does. Interconnected episodes, amazing conversations, investigative reporting. Check it out. And now back to our conversation with Mark Hijink. That approach has to be critical to a book like Focus. I'll hold it up here. We were just reading from it earlier, where you're reporting on something that's so vast. We like this book where you're talking about like people at a concert holding up phones as glowing beacons, but then you start to run through like the list of things with chips that could start glowing too, like laptops, every Wi-Fi router, every cell phone tower, the chips in every car, traffic light, washing machine, and smartwatch, pair of headphones, coffee machine, cameras. Like there's this whole sort of hidden from sight network of technology that enables all these wonders that we come to just take for granted every day. And now, like a lot of what we discuss in our book is about these systems that are sort of hidden from sight. So they're doing things on your behalf, and they're sort of doing it quietly in the background. And we thought that was really interesting, that there's almost like this emerging world of hidden software that's sort of running on hidden hardware. And ASML is right at the heart of that, because you're talking about a company that makes these simplistic chips, but ASML has this fundamental space in creating these really high-powered chips that offer us like the compute that we need to power AI.
Yeah, especially AI. You're definitely right. And if you look at you just mentioned that list in on the first page of the book, every device that contains chips, and we tend never to think about it because it's usually it works, and usually there are plenty of them. So there's no reason to worry about that, and until it doesn't, which happened during the chip shortage, and of course, chips as being the basic building block of modern society, it's also turning into a weapon, or like an economic weapon to slow down your competitor, like the US is doing with China, to prevent China from creating better AI. And ASML's it never realized that it got into this position because there was no geopolitical interest for chips for about two or three decades after the Iron Curtain drop. The era of globalization kind of propelled ASML along, and they really embraced that, and they benefited from the fact that concentrating all these fabs in just a small corner of the planet was becoming the best and most efficient way for this industry to grow.
Yeah.
Until, of course, geopolitics changed and the world changed, and ASML was kind of faced with the truth from the outside of the company, that it had become too important.
Mm-hmm. And if you looked at trying to remove ASML from your life, I don't know why anyone would do that, but let's imagine for a second, you were like, I will try to live my life without ever using any chip that was printed using ASML technology. You pretty much eliminated everything that's a complicated device, right? Every computer, every, like, you know, I think people used to say, like, the computer is the future, but it turns out it was the phone that's the future. But every phone, every computer, like, what are you left with?
Well, nothing. Well, actually, I had this discussion with a guy working at a semiconductor fab, and he has a house in South America, so in Suriname, which is a former Dutch colony. He has a house there, but he also needed a car there, and he didn't want a modern car. He specifically was asking for like a car of at least 20 years old, because it didn't have any chips in it. Because back in the jungle, you can't find anybody who's able to repair a modern day's car. And of course, technology has become, well, kind of hard for us to reach. Okay, it's in the phone, it's in your hands, but it's not very tangible if you look at the compute itself. And for me, the journey into ASML and its technology was also the surprising outcome that these chips are still very physical matter. So not only the machine, but also the chips that are being built with all these separate layers on top of each other. There's still a lot of physics involved, a lot of chemistry. And you don't realize it when you're in this digital space where you think that everything is working according to plan. But behind that, there's a whole world of, well, actually nature and people. And for me, that was interesting to discover, that it's not only just plain technology.
Yeah, even down to the chips themselves being unique and probabilistic. If you actually look at each chip being unique, like a fingerprint in essence, like it's not as deterministic as I think most people think. It's that you have these unique chips that are probabilistic, but then you have this apparatus that make them, you know, reliable and predictable. But it's and the complexity lies in trying to turn something probabilistic into something predictable.
Yeah, and there's a lot of error correction involved in the chip itself, also in the designs, and also in the machine that builds them. So the lithography machine is full of error correction because the machine itself has ingredients that have to be very accurate, so on a nanometer scale, but it's impossible to create parts or modules that are exactly the same size every time. So there's a lot of slack or error budget. So you need software to like correct these and to keep things balanced. So there's software in that. And ASML itself also is learning from its mistakes. It's about the basic, I think the basic ingredient of getting chip manufacturing to this level that it's becoming economically viable, that there are a lot of test runs. It's really about gathering data, getting this machine running. And then the book has described this special relationship between TSMC and ASML, that they kind of found each other, tweaking their way into like this perfect yield that TSMC needs to fulfill all the orders for their customers. And they do so by using a machine that is usually not perfect, but together with the ASML engineers, they kind of do all these data test runs and find a way to get to this yield that's usually high enough for a high volume production. But this is a process of testing, of tweaking, of iterating. So it's not just a switch. Now it's running. It's not a pencil factory,
right? And it's like a metaphor for, I think, where most companies are headed with harnessing AI, this probabilistic, non-deterministic software. And I keep, my experience on a day-to-day basis is interacting with senior managers that oftentimes I can see in their face, they just want the simplicity and determinism that they have and that was in the past. And looking forward, as it's as they're looking into the future of complexity that is required for them to lean into something that they've fought, right? It's been a battle of keeping simplicity in their organization versus leaning into complexity. And then you look at an ASML that did the opposite, like leaning into complexity, and then where they are as a result of that today, you know, and is that really where all companies are going? Because now simplicity is just taken for granted.
Well, the funny thing is that ASML had a kind of a different approach to embrace complexity, because complexity is part of an engineer's daily job. They like deep dives in hard problems. But lithography is like, it's not one technology, it's like a combination of mechatronics, optics, physics, chemistry, you name it, software, AI. So there are a lot of interesting problems for engineers to dive into. But for them to cooperate, there was a sort of a chaotic environment needed. And as I described the situation or the cooperation between TSMC and ASML, this really stems back from the 80s. It's a kind of a chaotic but also flexible and agile way of working, which also leaves out the option of having this moment of rest, because everything is always in motion. It's a very chaotic environment. And the CTO and the protagonist of the book, Martin van den Brink, he also tried to spur this chaos, because it kind of fosters creativity. Because in this industry where you need brilliant ideas from brilliant minds, you have to make sure you hear them and that they can interact together and try to help out each other or to improve their the ideas or to challenge them. So that was really the atmosphere that was created, and it didn't have a lot of hierarchy. And well, maybe it's because I'm Dutch that I'm kind of used to these flat organizations where there's not a lot. Well, it's a kind of a democratic way of cooperating, even with your boss. So you're supposed to challenge your bosses as well. And there's a reason for that, because if you're working at a technology company and the boss is always right, and the boss, well, determines what the blueprint is or the roadmap, he or she becomes the bottleneck of all the information. And ASML really made an effort to create a parallel compute or a parallel way of engineering to make sure that all the ideas popped up. And that was, I think, from day one, part of the organization. And they had to, because they started out with nothing. They were pushed out of Philips, like a spin-off, but most of the first engineers really didn't want to leave Philips because their pensions were way too good. And so they were in this feeble startup, but they didn't have any supply chain of themselves. So they had to reach out and build an ecosystem of suppliers. Well, for these suppliers to work together, you really have to make sure that they also provide knowledge, because, well, you want to innovate this machine that's very complex. And from day one, ASML needed to cooperate very closely with the optics provider, because that's like the basic ingredient of any lithography machine. And all the lenses are made by a German company called Zeiss, which is a company from another culture and another because, well, Germans are very hierarchic if you compare that to the Dutch. So there's more of politeness and distance. And this is very much not ASML's way of working. And Zeiss was also more of a research institute, because it takes ages to build a lens. And the glass has to grow from crystals, takes years, and the lenses have to be polished. So it's a completely different pace than ASML. ASML was always trying to get these machines out to their customers as quickly as possible. And Zeiss was, okay, let's slow it down. we need all the time for these lenses to be perfect.
Right.
And to synchronize these companies that really took, I think, about 10 to 15 years of these cultures to mix. But the end result is that's basically one business for two companies.
There's like a parallel between, so as you pointed out, there's like, you know, I in a former life, I worked in the tech side of the film industry, which is a very creative process. And it was very like lateral thinking, right? I think of it like a cookbook, right? It's not a story that begins at the beginning and goes to the end. It's recipes you pull as you need. And that is what process looks like. It's not completely unstructured. It's just tiny structures, tiny systems that you then combine together to make unique outputs. And you have all these threads going, right? You have all these different threads going that ultimately map produce somewhere at the back into some singular experience for a human. And
Rob, can I ask you, was it also an environment where people tended to help each other out if one was stuck, or?
Very much, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, very collaborative, but not because somebody tried to make it that way, but because that creative environment of non-hierarchy created an element of people not trying to better each other, right? It wasn't, oh, if I help you, then you'll win.
Yeah,
and I'm like trying to beat you.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think the thing that helps a situation like that prosper is that there's a very clear goal. And for ASML, the goal was always very clear in the long term. So there was a roadmap looking 10 to 15 years ahead. But also in the short term, that a new machine had to be, delivered in time in the first prototype. Even if it wasn't working perfectly or not at all, it has to be, at the customer's door in a fab in Asia at the right time. And I think for your example, there was a very clear common goal that kind of connected all the people working there, because there was an end product.
Yes.
And it, if you're like this ego trying to belittle your colleagues, or to think you're the one, the only one knowing the truth, for example, that's kind of a limiting factor. You're going to get kicked out, because the industry, especially I think the creative industry, like the movies, doesn't allow people to work like that for a long time.
Yeah, and what was really interesting about that industry, because it was so evolved, and had produced so many successes, was that within that framework, it was a very clear division between the hierarchical systems, which is the studio and the people that rented you the equipment, mm-hmm. and that enabled, and then the people that created. And it was also very clear that the people that enabled, the hierarchies, the VPs, and that we didn't care about, as we called them, the suits, they were there to support what we were doing.
Process, exactly. So the process itself was the most important,
yes.
And everything else has had to support that. I just heard this. I just visited the new CEO of ASML again for an interview, and because I'm just trying to keep myself up to date with the company. And so we were in his office. He's in Peter Wennings, the former CEO's office, and they put in a new table, like a really big meeting table, so they can increase their bandwidth. And I was asking him, why aren't you in the other president's room, a former room, Martin van den Brink's room? And it's a bit smaller, and it looks at a different part of the campus. But also he mentioned that Martin has a different meeting table. So he did these technology reviews, And he especially had this table made that was more like a triangle. And reason for that was that he could read everybody in the room, how they responded to his way of interacting with people, which wasn't not easy. He was very challenging and he often shouted, but he had to make sure that his message came across. And it, well, of course, it did hurt people's feelings, but he wanted to, well, create an emotion. He used this emotion to create motion with his employees. And it was a very direct way. And he's not a very pleasant a guy at first. He's trying to nag you, trying to push your buttons. But in the end, he's trying to challenge you to do better or to come up with a better idea and to challenge him. But for this to happen in a safe, kind of safe way, he needed to know what his boundaries were with another person. So he had to be able to look everybody in the eye. And if you're sitting at the head of like a square table or a long table, then it's very hard to read people. So Martin had this special table just to be able to make sure that his message came across. And I really liked it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I love the idea. Like, it's such a metaphor, a triangle table. Of course, it's different, but I doubt that's why he did it, just to be different. But it's just to accommodate
it's structure. Just practical. And he hated video meetings. And I must say, it's such a pleasure to meet with you guys and to share our thoughts like this. But it's so much better when you do it live in person.
100%.
I think computers don't. Computers are still not able to replicate that emotion or that sensation of two people sitting across a table and having a cup of coffee or tea, whatever, or a beer.
Yeah.
One thing that's
absolutely
interesting about the lithography process, the way you describe it, is these layers, right? Like, so that as these mask layers are being created, they're not identical. And so, and even at the atomic level, so it seems like, you know, ASML, a big part of what they're doing is like digging deeper into precision. And it's like the more precise you make tools, the more complexity emerges that you then have to kind of deal with. And so there's this pattern, like they're layering these masks so that it creates almost the illusion of a perfect chip in some ways. And that feels a lot like we talk about agent runtime environments a lot on this podcast, and it's sort of the same thing or a similar thing for AI, right? Because precision there becomes almost like personalization, right? Like the further you drill down into ways that you could make an experience more personalized and more useful to someone, the more complexity starts spilling out everywhere. And so I wonder, like, has ASML, is that pursuit always ongoing, like still trying to get more precise, or is it more about now like figuring out ways to do that pattern recognition and create sort of the precision that's needed out of the what they're able to produce?
Well, I think there's a combination of strategies. First of all, lithography is like the main tool linear shrinking, so building chips that have more transistors on the same surface, so you cram more compute on the same surface. But in the latest generations of chips and technology nodes, there's also been a lot of growth in the third dimension, which also is Moore's law, but then adding extra chiplets or extra parts of chips and on top of each other, and doing so in an advanced packaging process, which is used to be a thing that was done in a different fab, in a back-end fab, but it's becoming so complex that they're doing it in a clean room right now. So what you see happening is that all the big chip manufacturers like TSMC or Intel, they're all adding advanced packaging in their clean rooms. If you look back at the 40 years that ASML was creating this technology. Actually, you have to look back 50 years because the technology started at Philips in the 70s. So the first machines, they had the size of your neighbor's barbecue. Not really impressive, but it could do lithography in a very core and basic way. But throughout the decades, you see this machine growing while the chips and the accuracy are growing. So the chips are getting smaller, or the transistors are getting smaller, more dense, and the machine is growing like crazy. So the last generation of EUV machines called High-NA, I think it's 40 meters long. So it's about, help me out, 40 feet approximately. It's $400 million. And it's a crazy machine, and the lines are just 2 nanometers or less apart from each other. And if you look at the layers of the chip, I think the accuracy or the overlay is less than 1 nanometer. We're talking about atoms there. So ASML is still improving in that era, getting back to your question. But you also see that they need more compute to build new compute. So there's a lot of, if you walk into a modern day chip fab, there's a lot of data centers there. So you would think the chips are being created, well, to fill up all these crazy AI data centers. Actually, they themselves need their GPUs to do all the compute for metrology and inspection. There are crazy amounts of data they have to crunch. And that kind of helps getting all these, well, variations, these natural variations, because, well, as we discussed, chips are still like it's physical matter. And the more you drill in to the atoms, the less predictable it gets. And so you need a lot of experience to fulfill that process, but also a lot of data and a lot of test runs. And so ASML has been announced this partnership in an AI company from Europe called Mistral from France. And it's really a strategic move because they want to build their own models together with a trusted partner from France. And they need that to get to this next level, because it's going to get harder and harder to cram these transistors even closer to each other. They're still working on it. But the variation is going to take up a lot more data and a lot more compute to get all the metrology right. But if you do, then you can make more predictable chips. So your yield is higher, even on those highly advanced chips. So that strategy.
Isn't that crazy that, like, you have this company, ASML, that basically makes the only machine for advanced chips in the world, this one company. And that's interesting in itself. If something happens to them, we all just, the brakes screech on modern society as we know it. But then
don't jinx it,
I know. And then you flip it around, but they also need their own chips to create their own. It's like this circular thing where they need the chips they produce to create the chips that they produce.
I said don't jinx it, but they were already in this situation. During Corona, a lot of their suppliers were struggling to get the chips they needed to build the parts for ASML. So the snake was kind of biting itself in the tail, I think the expression is. So ASML was really pushed, especially by TSMC, because the automotive industry needed more chips. So TSMC needed more chip machines, and ASML had to create more capacity and ask its supply chain. 80% of these machines is coming from external sources, often single sources. So it's not easy just to replace a supplier. And these suppliers were waiting for TSMC. Actually, I spoke to a couple of people who were waiting for TSMC to deliver chips for them. It was a crazy situation. So that kind of, that has already happened. And it sure shows that the world is depending on this very valuable but also brittle chain, and the entire semiconductor industry. And I think the market output is like $700 billion a year, which is impressive. But it's just a handful of companies that are really specialized at doing one task, and these companies all know each other personally, and these are networks from people who have worked in the industry for decades, and they I describe them as bonds of trust, and because they're all depending on each other. And when politicians start rattling their cages, the system breaks down, as we have seen during the pandemic.
Yeah, a lot of people, anytime I tell them the story about ASML, and there's some part of them that almost disbelief, like, what do you mean? Why can't the US or China just create their own factory? And then I begin to explain, you know, what you explained in prior conversation, which is, you know, just the journey that they've been on, just iterating on their own ideas, you know, ideas built on ideas, built on ideas, built on ideas, take time and iteration. But they still don't get it. They're still like, come on, but can't they just throw a bunch of money at it?
Well, money doesn't do it. I think it's culture and expertise. The U.S., of course, was really the founding father of the semiconductor industry. Silicon Valley, of course, was named after it. And lithography was a U.S. game until it got to this level that it became harder. And EUV was so that's like the new technology uses a more a smaller wavelength, so it's actually a fine liner compared to the former wavelength, so you can write even finer lines with a lithography tool. And EUV was researched in the 80s and the 90s throughout the planet, also in Japan, also in Europe, and also in the US. And the US was mainly because of Intel. No, I should say Intel, huh? That's the way. Yeah. So the US was mainly because of Intel, very much interested in EUV, because Intel was the market leader, and it wanted to make sure there was a new technology that they could use for even better nodes. So they started and built out a prototype. It was a sort of consortium together with Motorola and the national labs. And they got this prototype running, and they thought, well, this costs about $250 million to build this one prototype. Let's throw another $500 million at it, and it might work. And in about 5 years, the first EUV chips will be ready. Well, there were about 15 years off, because it was too hard. And well, the main problem was also an American company that couldn't achieve what was needed, which was Cymer. And Cymer was a provider of light sources, of lasers, that were already in use for DUV technology, so this bit larger wavelength, and longer wavelength, actually. So DUV is a longer wavelength. And Cymer tried to get EUV running and provide it to ASML, but they couldn't do it. So the only way for ASML, because they had already betted on EUV to succeed, was to acquire Cymer. And that was the only way to throw more engineers at the problem, which was the way that ASML usually worked. If something is too hard for a supplier to accomplish, then we have to jump in, because we really need our suppliers to deliver. Otherwise, we are too late. If we wait until it works, we're definitely too late. Then we're going to be beaten by Nikon or Canon or other competitors. So there's always a sense of urgency, and also kind of awareness. They really notice when a supplier gets stuck. They don't want the surprises. And I think that was crucial that Cymer was bought, because that way, I think the number of engineers quadrupled in the first month already when Cymer was bought. And that was needed to get it running.
It's interesting that when you kind of put it all together, there's two things that strike me at the very, very top level. And the first is it's as how counterintuitive or counterstandard it is. A, you have a company that's more flat or multi-threaded than it is hierarchical. And then secondly, you don't have a supply chain that's designed to create competition and fuel competition. You have a supply chain of really close, tight, loyal relationships, which is mirroring. And it's these two things that allow this exceptional company with this exceptional technology, which is kind of the opposite of traditional thinking. You know, you see companies getting multiple vendors on supply chains.
Yeah, Rob, you touch on a sensitive topic there, I think. If you look back at how ASML was created, it's really, I call it the Rheinland model. That's like a European way of, it's a Rhenish model. So all these companies, all these countries along the river, the Rhine, they have this tendency to do, well, industrializing, but look ahead in the future. So they have a long-term vision, which is completely opposite. Just think about Swiss watches, for example. It's so there's a lot of craftsmanship involved, and there's also a long-term vision of a lot of added value, because you can buy a cheap watch anyway. But so they built these really complex tools, and it's a completely different approach from the Anglo-Saxon way of doing business, which is usually about optimizing profit and making sure that your next quarter's results are like perfect and they have a strong line and all the investors are happy. So at ASML's, at ASML, these two worlds collide, because it used to be really about money didn't matter. The company was really not careful in its early days in spending money. And there was a reason for that, because they were in a hurry. They wanted to create market share. And the only way to achieve that was to be faster than the competitors and to be in the fab faster and to make sure that their engineers or service engineers were there as the first ones to solve the problems. That was the approach. It was not really inexpensive. It cost a lot of money, but ASML didn't care. And they got... So it's not a founder's culture. That's also a huge difference with, for example, Silicon Valley companies, where there's a lot of investments. Help me out. Venture capital.
Yeah.
ASML, Europe hardly has any venture capital. And ASML kind of grew on the subsidies from for their research, mainly from The Hague, where the Dutch government resides, and from Brussels, from the EU. So in its early days, ASML was really depending on the government. But till they got to this level that they hadn't just enough market share, and sometimes they were lucky, they got these upturns in the chip industry, because it's cyclical, and they were there earlier than their competitors. And that was because, well, they didn't care about money. They just wanted their machines out as quickly as possible. And not caring about money, okay, in the end, it will, well, making profits is just was just regarded as a side effect. But if you look at the company this day, I think its market cap is about 350 billion euros. It's doing okay now, because it's enjoying the ride of the AI. Well, you call it the bubble, I'm not sure, but if I ask people at ASML, they say there's no bubble.
Yeah, I agree.
These chips are needed. There might be a bubble in the valuation of how AI is gonna add to our daily lives or make our work easier. Might be, but in the end, I think the technology will be used, and so the chip will be used as well. And that's, of course, what ASML hopes as well.
Yeah, I mean, bubble is the oversimplification of so many things. And bubble of what? Because AI is hard to define as a thing.
So oh, can we just do a little segue there?
Sure.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think there's a bubble element in it. So, for example, the kind of circular motion of money being slushed around between Oracle, NVIDIA, OpenAI, and AMD. So that's kind of hard to track and trace what's happening there.
Right, right.
And
yeah, like NVIDIA invests in a company that buys their chips back.
What is it? Is it like one hand in the pocket? Help me out. What's the expression?
Is there one with cookie jars too? No.
Yeah. So we have this Dutch expression, and it says it's like a cigar from your own box. Forget it. Thing with NVIDIA, I think the valuation is now over $5 trillion. But their market share has to diminish. They can't grow anymore. And so their biggest threat, as they perceive it now, is of course China, because a competitor might gain market share there because they're not allowed to export. But also you see AMD rapidly jumping on the strain of inference, which is going to be more compute than training eventually. And so if you dive, okay, let's get back into the ASML story. If you dive back into the kingmaker, now Jensen Huang is the kingmaker because he decides who gets the NVIDIA chips or the Hoppers or the Blackwells. And TSMC, of course, decides who gets the highly advanced capacity that's kind of sold out. So that's mainly NVIDIA and Apple. But in the end, it's ASML who decides who gets the highly advanced lithography tools you need for AI chips. There comes the twist, because ASML doesn't want to be the company that decides who gets chips or not. So they regard themselves as a neutral player. And I think it's one of the big benefits from being a Dutch player that we don't have our own semiconductor industry. We don't have our own manufacturing. So it's not really in our interest to give our to keep the best technology to ourselves. So ASML is a neutral player. Every customer can place its order, unless, of course, there's an export restriction or other regulation. They will definitely listen to that, because it's a company. It's not a political choice. But in the end, they want to be this neutral player. And they have to be, because they're a monopolist. And being a monopolist, if you're going to slow down some of your customers on purpose, then you're really on this path that's very hard to correct. And we've seen a lot of monopolies, fail. And I think ASML is very much aware of that.
I often think about companies in the form of just algorithms. There are a bunch of algorithms in the hierarchy. And one algorithm that I can't escape in this conversation is how ASML determines who gets the next lithography. Maybe it's just the simplest one, first come, first serve, whoever made the order first. What a simple algorithm for this all to boil down to one of the simplest ever.
I think you have a new job. You can work at ASML, because that's basically, their backlog is, whoever comes first. And what you saw happening during this huge uptake of China buying up a lot of lithography tools, so that had two reasons. There was a lot of demand in China, and of course they wanted to prevent being hit by export controls, who were sort of announced. So they ordered a lot of machines, but they came. Well, they had to find their place in line in the backlog. But there was a downturn in the industry. So a lot of other, for example, automotive customers from TSMC, they lowered their orders. So they pulled their orders. Yeah, that's the way. So a lot of other customers for TSMC lowered their orders, and you saw a general downturn in the entire Western industry, except for AI. AI was still doing great. But as a result, the number of the percentage of the revenue coming from China was almost half of ASML's revenue. But that was not because the Chinese were benefiting from ASML's change of mind, but others had left their place in line in the backlog. So they just moved ahead, and ASML built these machines according to order.
You know, it's funny how 50% of the orders, I think you said, in 2024, 2025 was China. And then the idea that, you know, no longer can they ship to China means half their orders are gone. But it doesn't explain it. That's not a clear picture because all they need is just enough orders to replace it, because they have a scarcity of how many they can produce. So just because half your orders are gone doesn't mean half your orders are gone.
Well, I have to correct you there, because they're still selling machines to China, but these are less advanced machines. And so they're expecting they're expecting the China revenue to come to this new, more normal level, which is 20%, which has always been the case. So okay, that's kind of normal. And if you compare it to their American peers, like Applied Materials or KLA, or even NVIDIA, they also rely on China for about 20, sometimes 25% of their revenue. So it makes sense for ASML to expect things getting back to normal. And there's also this realization that there's a new government in the U.S. that has another approach of the concept of national security. So the Biden era was very strict for national security. And it started off with this, small garden, high fence approach to prevent China from getting access to the most advanced chips. But at the Trump era has a new approach that says, well, some of the AI chips, well, the less advanced chips that NVIDIA builds, for example, H100s, they can, or H20s, I must say, they can be sold to China because, well, they're not top notch. And that way, NVIDIA can still build market share in China and make sure that the Chinese companies stay addicted to NVIDIA's or CUDA or its
right.
software.
Yeah.
So if you build on top of, if you build on that, you can kind of conclude that if NVIDIA is allowed to sell chips that are made by EUV machines, because the H20 is a 5-nanometer process, I think, you could also argue that, well, ASML should be able to sell the machines that provide these chips, that can build these chips, and maybe not EUV, but the more advanced DUV systems, which are now not allowed to move to China. And the Trump administration, I think, has a different approach when it comes to the concept of national security, because Trump is way more transactional than Biden was. He just wants to make a deal, and everything is on the table. And I think ASML sees that as a opportunity that the tide might be turning.
These tools being conversational in nature and feeling familiar might make it seem like automating things with them will be easier than it actually is, right? And tools now exist and strategies for companies to embrace complexity and really do what amounts to systemic change. But it's starting to feel more and more like fewer companies will be able to kind of push through that point solution phase and into systemic change. So I wonder if much in the way ASML did something extraordinary and kind of ran into complexity using a blend of cultural aspects and the way they structured their business, they're very, very unique. And, you know, the first organization to really crack the code on integrating AI might might be more might be closer to ASML than to a traditional company that we see today, because to really dig in and make it work, right, you're like doing what you're talking about. You're just unearthing more and more complexity. And
Excellent point. Can we just follow up on that? Because one of the things I think AI is really good at is helping out in limited scenarios. And litho is complex, but in the end, ASML is a one-trick pony. It really tries to solve the problem of replicating the same structure over and over, a very fine structure, in the most economical way. So it adds a lot of value to its customer. So the problem itself is kind of confined, which also explains that there's a common goal for all the people at ASML. But in these like more limited use cases, it's easier to trust AI because there are less edge cases. And I'm kind of pessimistic personally when it comes to the added value of AI in these very broad brush approach. Of course, it's a great chat client, but I always compare it to autonomous vehicles, so self-driving cars. So they operate in traffic, which is a highly regulated environment, a very limited use case, actually. And you see how many times things go wrong. I'll express myself in a decent way. So there are still a lot of edge cases. And the only way for these cars to thrive is to limit their reach, for example. These streets are allowed, or these cities. And it takes a lot of learning processes. And they still are more careful than the most human drivers. And I think just throwing data at models doesn't help you solve any problem in any business. And AI changing the world, I think it's still going to be one step at a time.
Yeah, we sort of look at it in a similar lens. You've got the car, you got the streets, and you've got the chaos.
That's a nice way of putting it. Yeah.
and the one of the things that we haven't seen yet is organizing the streets for the cars. The cars were built for us to drive, and there's a lot that could be done with the streets to allow AI to be more effective on the streets. And I think in companies, they have that opportunity to create more of a, that's what a runtime is to us. They can create an environment that's conducive to these things. So it's kind of a meeting in the middle of complexity to say, we're going to simplify and align the streets, because cars can see in different frequencies than we can. You know, they can hear at different frequencies than we can. And they can see in more directions than we can. And if you just put beacons and you just started designing the streets for these things, like China's doing, right, then you start to sort of find the middle. And I think with companies, all of their processes are designed, again, for humans, but they can change those, right, and sort of meet the complexity in the middle.
I really enjoyed the way that the Chinese self-driving vehicles were just flying through traffic, even in construction zones, which was kind of really the proof that it can work for AI to operate within a human environment like traffic. Because, well, I agree, our cities are not built for robocars. And if you ever visited Amsterdam, you see a lot of people on bikes or bicycles, and it's really kind of chaotic. And any self-driving car would be braking all the time, because everybody else is not waiting. Dutch people are not very polite usually, especially not in traffic. So, but building completely new cities is an option. The question is, do you want to live in a city like that? Is it still environment that you feel human in? Or do you feel surrounded by mechanics, by apparatus, by robots.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mind if that's outside the city and I can bicycle in the city.
Okay.
You know, like compartmentalize it for me. Yeah.
I'll definitely just sign up for that. Okay. Now we're just talking about, I do have a car that has like this advanced cruise control. So it is adaptive. And it's also addictive because when I'm on the highway, I really trust the car to keep the distance. It's really like an extra safety belt for me. And that's the kind of technology I like, that it helps me do my job better, being more fit when I get out of the car and be less of a danger to the other people in traffic. So I think that's a great marriage of technology. And it's simple. And for AI, I think a lot of the solutions are like over complex.
Agreed.
Think of the cruise control.
So I think, you know, it was a technology problem, and it's now a design problem, designing AI into our lives, and because the technology is handled. And I think some people, in my opinion, lack imagination for how we would do this well, and imagine us doing a really poor job of this and thinking life's going to get worse. And then there's people that I know that are designers that have great imaginations for this and imagine like, well, the world's going to be great. And I don't know who's right. Are we going to empower designers, and are we going to design these experiences to be great ones, or are we going to design them to be terrible ones? I don't know. But I like to think that design does get better, generally speaking.
Yeah. And if you look how fast things have moved, since like 3 years, I think ChatGPT was out 3 years. The technology was already there for about 6 years, I think. And so everybody jumped on it. There really nobody holding back. All the investments were there. I think it's also, apart from a design issue, also an adaption problem. That the first leap was very impressive. But you also see how easy and how flexible our human minds are, that we now see, okay, this is AI, we're getting used to it, we're not shocked anymore by fake images, or we even recognize text that is created by AI. So I think the human way of adapting to the human ability to adapt to new technology is still really impressive, and I think AI proves it.
Yeah,
you find a way to work with it.
Yeah, and if you look at how younger people interact with technology, especially social media, they have it, from my experience, more of a tendency to see in gray. They don't see true and false, because everything's so faux false or faux true in the virtual world, and they don't care. They sort of shrug it off, you know. Like,
okay,
they look at things and they sort of go, yeah, true or false. Like, they go falsish, true-ish.
Yeah, we have we often use a German expression called "jein," so that's ja und nein, yes and no at the same time.
Ah, there you go, love it. But we need that.
But just to come full circle, don't envy today's youth, because I think we all got to spend our youth without any cameras, without, well, maybe some internet, but really was privacy, and I never cared about anybody following my path or knowing my location. And so I felt a lot more freedom than today's youth, because whenever you do anything wrong, things are being expanded and
overanalyzed and amplified.
You're really and amplified. Sorry, that's so.
Yeah.
And there's no way of turning that back. And so you really have to be careful. And I never experienced that as a kid. I felt total freedom. Even, of course, even in the Netherlands, quite a liberal country, so I did everything that I wanted and that my parents didn't want me to do, which my daughter can't, because well, I hope she does, but of course there's a lot of technology just tracing her around anywhere she goes.
And you could walk out of the bathroom with toilet paper stuck to your shoe and only a few people saw you. Now everyone in the school sees it, or everyone in your neighborhoods.
Yeah, and shares it, and well, you're done forever. But okay, I think they'll find their way to adapt as well.
Yeah.
It's true. They'll have to.
Cool,
man.
This was terrific. Really enjoyed this conversation.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Awesome, guys. Thank you so much.
All right. Well, thanks for hanging out with us again here on Invisible Machines. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Always remember that you can watch this podcast, too, on our Invisible Machines YouTube channel. Head over to uxmag.com. We have a podcast page there where you can explore our back catalog, and you can look at episodes centered around popular topics. Many, many thanks to our incredible production team here in the U.S. and in Ukraine, Elias Parker, Michael Litvinov, Allison Harshberger, Alla Slesarenko, Vera Pokolkov, and Darina Moskovchuk. Till next week. Owagi.